Hey, this is Glam Outlook live from London. You're listening to The Vinyl Guide with my good new chum, Nate, who's living in the wrong place, really. Well, I don't know about that, but there you go. But we've been chatting about my latest album, Good To Go, amongst other things.
Hey, everyone. It's Nate, host of The Vinyl Guide. Thanks for tuning in. As you've heard this week, we have Glenn Matlock here on the show. We are talking music and career. He talks about his time with Sex Pistols, The Rich Kids, Iggy Pop, and of course, we chat about his latest solo album Good To Go, which is available on vinyl everywhere. Just ask your local record shop for it, or as he suggests today, you can get a vinyl copy off Amazon. Now, I'll play a track from this Good To Go album directly after the interview. I'm really enjoying this record. Maybe you will too. Now, Glenn and I cover a lot of ground today, including the formation and the early days of Sex Pistols, which, of course, Glenn wrote or co-wrote the majority of the songs that ended up on Nevermind the Bollocks, including favorites like God Save the Queen and Anarchy in the UK. What's interesting, though, is that Glenn didn't play on the Nevermind the Bollocks LP. The bass player was the guitarist Steve Jones, so the bass is played very similar to the guitar, the same notes being struck in the same way as the guitar chords. So if you want to hear how the songs were originally written to sound, check out the Sex Pistols Spunk Demos, which was recorded while Glenn was still in the band. The quality isn't as clear as Nevermind the Bollocks, but it's somewhat refreshing to hear a bass line that's not just a direct translation of the guitar chords. So check it out. Sex Pistols Spunk is available on all the streaming services. You can find it on YouTube as well. Additionally interesting is that the release date of Nevermind the Bollocks was pulled forward to combat a bootleg version of Spunk, which was coming out on vinyl, which is why we have so many vinyl variations of Nevermind the Bollocks. There's an extremely hard to find Blue Virgin blank back 11-track vinyl edition. There's the 11-track UK pressing with a one-sided single for submission. There's the 12-track version that has submission on the record, but they totally forgot to make mention of it on the back of the album. Early pressings of Nevermind the Bollocks, quite frankly, are a huge mess. But if you can get your hands on one of the early Virgin presses, especially the Blue Label Virgins, those are the best sounding versions you can get. I've got several. I've got a blank back, which is generally regarded as the first UK pressing, mostly made to export out of the UK, but it's got awful song sequencing. I mean, the songs are just jumbled up. It doesn't flow right, but the record sounds fantastic. My favorite pressing of Nevermind the Bollocks would be the UK second pressing, where all the songs are on the record and it's sequenced in the traditional song sequence which we're used to, which flows far, far better than the first pressing. That is my absolute favorite. I'll put pictures of it up on Instagram.com/vinylguide. The US pressings of Nevermind the Bollocks were disappointing, and even the modern represses seem to lack the energy and the clarity, as if they're coming off a few generations of tape just to make the lacquer. But look, I digress. Listen to the Spunk Demos. It's got Glenn playing bass. You know, if you tune into the bass, it's like a whole new view to those classic songs. And quite frankly, whether you're playing a rare Blue Virgin blank back vinyl pressing of Nevermind the Bollocks or a UK first pressing of The Rich Kids' Ghosts of Princes and Towers, you'll want to clean your records with the Groove Washer Record Cleaner. Now look, the Groove Washer is the best manual record cleaner out on the market, bar none. There's nothing that comes close, and the Groove Washer is the best bang for the record cleaning buck. Kits starting at around $15 with record cleaning bundles and gift packs around $50. Head over to groovewasher.com and guess what? Here is a 10% off promo code that'll get 10% off everything at the groovewasher.com store. Enter code VINYLGUIDE10 at checkout and that will get you on the fast track to clean and wonderful sounding records. It's the Groove Washer. I use it daily and I am a vinyl maniac. I trust my records and my ears to the Groove Washer, and so should you. 10% off with promo code VINYLGUIDE10. All right, here we go. Let's talk to Glenn Matlock, and stay tuned after the interview for a track from his new LP, Good To Go.
Morning, wake up and find me gone.
This week on The Vinyl Guide, we have on the show as our guest Glenn Matlock, who you may know as a founding member of Sex Pistols, but that's just part of his resume. Also founding member of Rich Kids, played with the likes of Johnny Thunders, Iggy Pop, The Damned, and more. And now Glenn is celebrating his latest solo LP, Good to Go. How are you doing this morning, Glenn?
Goodness, good night. You all right? Getting there.
Man, I tell you, I am having a lot of fun with this new LP, Good to Go. Was it half as fun to make as it is listening to it?
Yeah, but it was quite easy to do. Everybody sort of rubs along quite well. Everybody rubs each other up quite well, but you know, in a kind of a friendly way. But everybody, I think, respects each other as a musician. You know, if you've got the right people around you, you're kind of happy to just let them get on and do their thing within reason. That's kind of what we did. So it was a good team. It was done in quite a short burst of time, or the vast majority of the loud bits, you know, the drums and the guitars and things. And I took a bit more time with the vocals, you know, not being the great Caruso. You just got to kind of find your voice. And sometimes with songs, you might get all the music down, but you're not quite happy with the lyrics. So these days you can record at home the vocals and just kind of get it as right as you possibly can without watching the clock ticking. So that's what I did with that. Not all of them, but some of the songs were kind of more of a fledgling idea lyrically. But I should think most people do that really anyway, you know.
You've been a songwriter for so many years. I mean, really your whole life. I mean, do the songs still kind of flow from you as easy as they used to?
Yeah, sometimes they do, but not everyone. You know, I mean, the best song for me is something that you write in half an hour flat, because you've got an idea that's burning your head about something, you got something you feel you want to rail about, and the music and the lyric kind of comes together. Sometimes you just get a riff, or sometimes you just get a lyrical idea, and they're the ones you have to sort of sweat over a little bit more. But the thing to do is to kind of just realise when you got an idea. And I tend to write a lot of songs just by walking down the street. You see something, it kind of gets your mind thinking, and you might get a little tune. And when those ideas don't go away, that's when it's then time to pick up the guitar. If the idea does go away, then that's the answer to that one, because if you're trying to write catchy songs, which I am, if you can't remember it, how on earth do you expect anybody else to remember it?
So when you look back at your catalog of songs, which are the ones that flowed from you the easiest?
Which ones? Well, having said that, there's not that many, really. I think the song Rich Kids came quite easily. Ghost Princes and Towers came quite easily. Pretty Vacant kind of came easily. My music for Anarchy in the UK was kind of pretty much made up on the spur of the moment, although I had a little ragtag bag of half ideas in the back of my head when I sort of managed to put myself on the spot with Steve Jones, and it coincided with what John was thinking about.
Do you come up with the lyrics or the riffs or a little bit of both?
Both.
Okay. Because I heard the story Pretty Vacant was developed in a guise to be able to say the word on radio. Is there any truth to that?
No. And obviously you've got a grown-up listenership there. But no, I wrote the lyric. It didn't even occur to me. And when I showed the words to John and we'd run through it several times, he turned to me and he said, "Oh, great, you give me a way of saying that on the radio." But it was that way around, not the other way around.
Okay.
I hadn't even thought of that.
Okay. That's a collaboration there.
Yeah, I was more interested in my artistic integrity bit of it. Anyway, it's Kant by Kant.
Yeah, but it comes through. Yeah. So I get the feeling that the new album, Good to Go, is there's more than a subtle nod to the records that initially inspired you to play. When I listen to it, I hear inspiration from the likes of Elvis and Gene Vincent and Jerry Lee Lewis and the Type. Am I on the same frequency?
Kind of a little bit, but you don't want to hear me playing the piano, right? Yeah, but there's a whole bunch of other stuff. I mean, the reason I made the album like that is because I've actually been doing, over the past 15, 20 years now, loads of just acoustic shows around the world. And people tend to like it because, you know, just me, solo shows. And because they say that the songs come through kind of better. So on most of the album, I don't even play bass. I've got somebody in to do that. And I play guitar. I'm wanting to concentrate on fronting the project. And that's why I picked Slim Jim, because he's got, you know, only half a drum kit. He's more of middleweight boxer than a heavyweight. You know, he's a bit more nimble on his toes. He suggested El Slicko, I'd met a few times before. And everything kind of slotted in. But yeah, there's you know, I like people like Ronnie Lane. I like Ray Davis. I like the Everly Brothers. I like bits of Johnny Cash. It's all sort of in there somehow.
Yeah,
and go with rock and roll. And of course, you're playing with Slim Jim. It's going to give it a rockabilly flavour. But that wasn't by accident. I wanted that. You know, I like, I'm kind of fed up with punk music, all the way through everything. If I'm going to do that, I'll do that with the Sex Pistols. And I just wanted it to swing a little bit more.
Well, certainly does. I mean, and what were the records that you had as a kid that you looked to for inspiration? Which are the songs that captured your attention?
The very first records I had were some 78s that my uncle had given me. We had a big old radiogram at home. And the ones you mentioned earlier, Jerry Lee Lewis, Elvis Presley, the Big Bopper, El Bostic, I think there was Gene Vincent one, you know, but big old 78 discs. And this is when I'm like 5, 6 years old, and I put them on, and you put them on and go and stand over the other side of the room, because they ran around so fast, you thought they was going to fly off and take your head off. You know? And so that was, you know, to hear those songs coming out on this radiogram, big old valve, mahogany thing, just the sound of it was great. And, you know, then so I'm becoming to be 8, 9 years old, and I got hip to pop music, and there wasn't a national radio station back then. And all these pirate radio stations sprung up, and that kind of coincided with all the kids having transistor radios. So we would listen to Radio London, Radio Caroline, Luxembourg, which wasn't strictly a pirate radio station, but they played the Kinks and Who and the Yardbirds and the Stones and the Small Faces. And then not long after that, there was I think it was the best TV show in the world ever, called Ready Steady Go. Even Generation X wrote a song about it. And all those bands would play live, coupled with Dusty Springfield was on the show quite a lot, and she went to America and discovered Motown and brought over people like, you know, Sam Cooke and Junior Walker, and that's what got me going. And then later on, tail end of the 60s, early 70s, when I was starting buying records for myself, I went down this place called the Portobello Road, and there was a record stall there, which was Rock On Records, Ted Carroll's Rock On Records, which is actually featured in the song The Rocker by Thin Lizzy. I get my records through in a rock on stall. And I was flicking through the racks, and I found a record that looked like an old-fashioned 78. It was in a cardboard sleeve with stitching down the middle, with a hole in the middle, and the Mercury label thing kind of shone through with a little bit of cellophane. And I just bought it because it looked like these old 78s that my uncle had given me. And it happened to be the Faces' second album, Long Player. Uh-huh. And I got into them. And I didn't even realize at the time that they were like, you know, a follow-on from the Small Faces, because it was three guys from the Small Faces and Ronnie Wood and Rod Stewart. So that, and through them, it got me into the blues. It got me into, you know, taking the Temptations more seriously. It got me into David Ruffin, I believe, was in Bobby Womack. So it was kind of a bit of a door, you know. Mm-hmm. It was the door in the back of the wardrobe to kind of a cooler set of music. And the big deal with them is that I actually got to play with them.
Yeah, you got to play with your heroes. That's amazing.
Yeah, Rod didn't, but Ronnie and Kenny and Neil McLagan did. Who I roped in when I played with the Rich Kids. He played on the track on the album, did a tour with us. Mm-hmm. So, you know, and I find rock and roll music is it's a bit like a relay race, you know, you're sort of passing on the baton to the next bunch of people that come along.
In the early days, were you able to go to live concerts? Was there enough money to keep records coming in, or was it a very rare occasion when you were able to bring something new home?
Kind of rare. I always worked, you know, but then there's always a toss up between football, having your drink, going out with girls or buying a record, you know. That was that. But I did work on Saturdays really early on in a shop, just filling up the shelves, you know, for me pocket money. Mm-hmm. But because of that, I missed the Stones in Hyde Park.
Oh, you had to work that day?
I had to work that tight. I wasn't happy about that, and I knocked it on the head after that. And not, well, maybe a bit, quite a bit after that. I did go and see Humble Pie supporting Grand Funk Railroad in Hyde Park, which was fantastic, but Humble Pie blew my stage. So, you know, those kind of sort of early 70s bands, some of the more rock ones were what inspired me.
Now, you're talking about some of the Motown artists, and I know Stax did a handful of tours in the UK. Do you remember when they came through?
No, because I think I was too young then, really. I mean, you know, it's kind of getting, when I started it in gigs with a Vengeance, it was really late, 60, probably, well, 1970, I would have only been 14, you know.
And when did you go from listener to participant?
When I met Steve and Paul, really.
You didn't play before you met them?
I was learning in my bedroom. I'd sort of had a couple of sort of jam sessions with mates at school, but no, that was my first proper band. Oh. So that was the first. And we rehearsed in slightly. There was another guitarist involved, a guy called Wally Nightingale. Steve was a singer originally. Steve picked up the guitar and started getting better on it. Wally didn't really fit in. And then we kind of got involved with Mountain McLaren and decided to take it a whole lot more seriously. But there was other things going on in London at the time. I remember, I think it was probably 1973, I'd heard about this band called, no, maybe a bit later, 74, I heard about this band, the New York Dolls, that Malcolm McLaren then went on and had something to do with, and they played at a place called Bieber, but I wasn't kind of old enough and hip enough to go then, but the Faces were playing at Wembley. They'd had a big hit with Stay With Me by then, and I saved up me work money and I went to see the Faces at Wembley. No idea who was supporting them, but lo and behold, the New York Dolls were supporting them, and they were just totally something different. They were so exciting and had a real attitude and couldn't give a damn about anything. And all the things started slotting together, you know, we're meeting Steve and Paul and told them about it, and Malcolm already knew about it. And that was the original band with Billy Dole. He died about a week after that, sadly.
So Malcolm McLaren came into the scene quite early, it sounds like. I mean, how much time were you and Steve and maybe Paul together before Malcolm got involved?
Well, no, it was through Malcolm that we got together, because by then I was working for Malcolm.
Okay.
Again, just on Saturdays while I was still at school and before I went to college. And I met Steve and Paul in his teddy bear shop down at King's Road. You know, he didn't put us together. We put ourselves together in his shop, and we had to cajole him to get involved a bit more. And it's a silly story here. Malcolm didn't really see it and thought it was rubbish, and he probably was back then. But I used to work there on Saturdays and then started working like through the week a bit later on. And I used to go and see a band called that Sensational Alex Harvey Band. You know, I saw them in pub. And I saw them sort of climb up the greasy pole of bigger gigs. And then one week I was in there by myself and the Alex Harvey Band come in and I'm selling them stuff. And it was in the winter, so people had big coats on. And Alex Harvey looked a bit like a sort of straighter middle-aged guy with National Health Service glasses on and an overcoat. And the other guys were a bit bigger than him. And all of a sudden, the door burst out, and Malcolm McLaren came in with a box, with a delivery of stuff. And he looked in horror, and he said, "Glenn, come here." And he took me to the back of the shop. I said, "What's going on?" He said, "Who's those guys?" I said, they're customers, I'm serving them, they're buying all this stuff. He said, no, who are they? I said, they're a band, the Sensational Alex Harvey Band. No, they're not. You know, I never heard of them. Well, who do you think they are then? And he said, get them out. I said, why? I said, who do you think they are? He said, they're tax collectors. Right? And I went, what? You're kidding me. And kind of looking back, in fairness, maybe Alex Harvey could have been a tax collector and the rest of the guys in the band could have been his sort of heavies, you know. So obviously Malcolm was paranoid about something. But by that time, the Alex Harvey Band had had a real big hit record with a cover of Delilah, and were playing at Hammersmith Odeon. So I took, I didn't buy the tickets, but I organised going to the Hammersmith Odeon with my mate Nick Cash, who ended up in a band. He was my mate from art college. Bernard Rhodes, who went on to manage the Clash, and Malcolm McLaren, to go to the Hammersmith Odeon to prove to Malcolm that the Alex Harvey Band weren't tax collectors, right? And while we're sitting there, Malcolm turned to me and he said, how much was it to get in? And I think it was about £1 a ticket. And he said, how many people here? And I said, I'm not sure. I think it's about 2,500. He said, he looked at me, he said, let's have a meeting about the band in the morning.
So he saw the dollars.
Yeah. Because up to then, Malcolm, he was like a teddy boy, clothes shop, and all he ever went to gigs and listened to was old 50s records. You know, and he knew nothing about contemporary music apart from his. It's about in tandem with the time he started sort of caught in the tail end of the New York Dolls. Mm. It's funny how things all sort of butterfly flaps its wings.
Oh, that's amazing. How often did you guys practice? Like, what was the routine of the Sex Pistols early on?
Originally, it was sort of once a week or something like that. But then we started taking it more seriously and we tried a few different rehearsal places, which were expensive and not that. And I was flicking through the Melody Maker one day. Melody Maker was a weekly news magazine, a newspaper, but weekly. And it had all adverts in the back. And I was looking through it, and I saw in it, there was an advert, it said Denmark Street, Timpan Alley, which is where all the music shops are in England, lease for sale on premises. And I showed it to Malcolm. And he went, oh, that looks good. He said, call the bloke up and offer him £1,000 without seeing it. And I said, what? He said, no, do it. So I did. And the guy at the other end said, well, what? Yeah, all right. I think we can talk business. So we went to see it. And the guy who had the place, it used to be Badfinger's place. And two of them had topped themselves by then. And they were, you know, he was trying to sort of clear up their assets. It was a rehearsal space. And the guy, Bill Collins, I don't know if you've ever seen that TV show The Professionals, which Stephen Paul named their band after. Okay. His son was in it, Lewis Collins, right? He was just starting out as an actor at that stage. And anyway, he liked us and he took us under his wing. I don't think ever he got his £1,000, but we then had our own permanent rehearsal place and somewhere for me and Steve to live, right in the middle of Soho. It was fantastic. And it was a real dive. It was like, you know, Americans had loft. It was our kind of loft, really. But we could leave the gear set up. We had nothing better to do. We had no money. So we just used to rehearse every day and work out ideas. You know, normally what happens with bands, fledgling bands, you rehearse every week. Somebody has an idea. And by the end of the week, when you get to finally play it in front of everybody, you go, oh, that's no good. So at least we could rehearse every day, and if somebody had an idea, you could find out there and then that the idea was no good and move on to the next one. So it kind of tightened things up a bit.
Yeah, so the songwriting process of the Pistols, you would bring in your ideas, workshop them with Steve, I guess till you whittled down to those 10 or 12 core songs that I think most people know, yeah? How many songs did you go through that didn't make the cut?
Not that many, actually, because, you know, there'd be half a riff and people would get bored with. There was maybe a couple, but I can't think of many that didn't last the course. And then lots of other things we did didn't really kind of come out, but we did lots of covers because basically we was just trying to get a set together. Mm-hmm. And sometimes ideas for songs come from you try and learn a song that somebody else has done. And when you can't play that well initially, it's a bit hard and it don't sound anything like what you're trying to play. And it ends up like you think, oh, well, we've got something new here. You know, there's kind of like artistic integrity by ineptitude and default. So some things happen like that, really. But it was fun, you know, and it was exciting to be on that. But I think we all individually improved as kind of songwriters. But I think we kind of then went off in different directions. But where all that pistol stuff come, you know, it was like kind of some four railway lines converging, and where they actually met, it was a big explosion, and that's where the band came from. But then, you know, train kept a roll and everybody sort of went off in there, continued in their different directions.
Does it surprise you these days, kind of realizing how long those songs are lasting and how embedded they are into our brains?
No, they're still only 3.5 minutes long each.
You know what I mean. You cheap.
Yeah, I know what you mean. yes, people certainly like him. It's surprising. Never really thought past the end of the month. So the end of the week, really. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a constant. It's not only here, it's all around the world. Whereabouts in Australia are you?
In Sydney.
Sydney, okay. Like Sydney.
Are you going to come out here at any time soon?
I'd like to. I was over there about 2 years ago, year and a half, 2 years ago. Like being in Sydney, and it's a good time of year to start thinking about.
Exactly.
I've got friends and relations in both Sydney and Melbourne, so I'm kind of slowly working on that.
Yeah, I see you turning around, going to Japan, you're doing some other tours. I think you're going to the US this year as well, aren't you?
No, I've already been, but maybe I might go back as well. You know, it's just fitting it all in somehow.
Mm-hmm. So the Denmark Street Rehearsal Room, there were some demos recorded there, which turned out to be from Dave Goodman, I believe, that turned out on this recording called the Spunk LP. It was a bootleg that ended up competing with the Nevermind, the Bullocks album. What are your memories of recording those songs, those sessions with Dave Goodman?
Well, basically, Dave Goodman was our sound engineer. He used to do all the live shows with us. He had a small PA system. He had a van. He had a Revox 4-track tape machine, which he used to run to get the tape echo on John's voice. And then we needed some recordings, and we had a rehearsal place, and he suggested to Malcolm that why don't we have a bash? I think he wanted to be the producer. And why don't we have a bash at recording it in our own rehearsal place, which is what we did. So all the rhythm tracks come from that, and it's only kind of good enough to then take those tapes to a studio and do some more overdubs and things. And that's David, the demos that got us the record deal. But then, as you say, it was a bootleg, but somebody put it out. I've found out in recent years it was actually Malcolm.
So Malcolm was the one, that was going to be one of my questions. So Malcolm was the one that leaked that tape for the bootleg?
It would appear so, yeah.
Oh, okay. Can I ask how you found that out?
Through somebody that was putting out one of my records who came clean about it.
Okay.
It might come back to bite him. I'm not saying that.
Okay. All right. Well, Malcolm's dead now. He can't suffer any consequences for it, so.
No, but the other bloke might be, and we'll see.
Okay. All right. So you're 100% certain. You're going on the record. Malcolm's the one that leaked it.
That's what I was told, yeah.
Okay. Another mystery solved. But
you know, that's a band's only a really good band if people think they're worthwhile bootlegging.
Yeah.
So there's kind of that going on as well, you know.
Well, I actually like those recordings on the Spunk LP better. Sonically, they're not as rich, but the musicianship seems to be better because there's a bouncing bass line in many of those things. It's not the same kind of bass line that's aligned with the guitars, like Nevermind the Bullocks. So I think they have a bit more life in them on that Spunk LP.
Yeah, well, I think that's probably, you got the same view on it as me. But I do think Chris Thomas's production is great, but what's lacking is, because I think sort of Stephen Paul's playing is great, but it's very black and white, and I think what I did was give it a bit of colour in the same way that maybe Entwistle did in The Who. You know, there's a counterpoint going on, and I think the record that come out, it didn't have the counterpoint, so people like it, but, you know, yeah.
Absolutely. So let me ask you this. During the years of royal events like the Jubilee, do royalty checks from songs like God Save the Queen and Anarchy in the UK, do they go up during those times?
No, I don't really think so. I don't know. It's, you get paid so far in arrears, it's hard to keep tabs on it.
Okay. Yeah, like I'm wondering when the Queen dies, if it'll get you a new house. So you then formed Rich Kids. Rich Kids? Okay, so you formed The Rich Kids. At that point when you exited Sex Pistols, was that a good time for you? Did the Pistols lineage help you, or did it make it more difficult?
I think it's a double-edged sword, really. You know, there was a backlash. See, when I formed The Rich Kids, it would have been very easy for me to have done a second division Sex Pistols, which is what I didn't want to do. And I wanted to do, you know, and I'd done that, and the Pistols and wanted to just move on a little bit, slightly. And, you know, to get Midge, who was a real big teeny bop idol at the time, he was in a band called Slick. It really put the cat amongst the pigeons. Now, that was my decision to do that, but I did it deliberately. But some people really loved it and some people hated it. And some of the people who hated it were people who were only still just getting into punk. And I remember, you know, after the Richards, I played with Biggie Pop and we played in Paris and Malcolm McLaren turned up and freeloaded this meal that the record company took us for. I wasn't so happy about him because he'd really bad-mouthed me after I left the band. And even though I'd sort of come up with a lot of the stuff that made them famous. But he'd had a bit of a drink and he said to me, he said, the thing with the Richards, Glenn, he said, it was kind of a good idea, but... You know, and in London it was cool, but as soon as you go up to the north of England, people thought that you were taking away from them what they'd only just got into too soon already, which is kind of a valid point. But on the other hand, there were hipper people in the north of England, and I think we inspired them. And although the Rich Kids had some success but weren't a runaway success, you know, I firmly remember... A fledgling Duran Duran coming to check us out at Barbarella's in Birmingham. And then when I did something more recently, we did a Richards Reformation and poor old Steve New had passed away and Gary Kemp from Spandau Ballet played guitar. And Gary's a good guitarist and nice bloke and mates with Midge. He said to me, he said, you know what, me doing this, it must have been what it was like for you when you played with the Faces, because we was big fans and we used to come and see you all the time, you know, and we inspired Spandau Ballet. Now, whether that's a good thing or not, I don't know. But, you know, it's that kind of handing on the baton thing.
Yeah, no, I can totally hear it. When you're listening to the Rich Kids album, you could hear things that I think would inspire other musicians. And like you say, Duran Duran, Tears for Fears. I almost hear like some echoes of Joy Division in there. Yeah, absolutely. Well, how come it was only a one and done? How come it was only one album from the Rich Kids?
How come? Because Midge and Rusty sort of... Rusty Egan, the drummer, and Midge, the singer, they sort of discovered the electronic music, you know, people like Kraftwerk and you know, stuff along those lines, which I'd already been hip to and liked, but, you know, I didn't want to play music like that. And they did a side project with a guy called Steve Strange as Visage, and it took off. And then there was a club in London which Rusty DJed at, he still DJs, and called Club for Heroes. And everybody, you know, it was the birth of the new romantic thing and wearing silly hats all the time and stuff. And they wanted the band to go like that, and I didn't want to do that. I wanted to be a rock and roll band. So in a way, they were right, but it wasn't what I wanted to do, and it broke the band up.
Right. Okay. Rumor has it, at that time, you almost wound up in the Clash. Is that correct?
When I fell out with the Pistols and I went out for a drink with Mick Jones and Joe Strummer, then it was like my kind of commiseration thing, but I was quite happy about it, really. They were kind of sort of sniffing, what are you going to do now, you know? And it was like implied thing of like, oh, you know, we could sort of do with the bass player thing. And I think although Paul Simonon was great looking guy, he wasn't the best player at that stage, he became better, but I said, well, no, you got Paul, you know. But looking back, I think Steve and Paul actually kind of fancied having Paul Simonon, and I think if it wasn't going to work with me, maybe they would have preferred to have Paul, but Paul was already in the Clash by then. So it's all these kind of things going on. But the Clash, kind of like the Clash. Although they were friends, I didn't think they were so great at that stage, but they became really good, you know, and I liked the period when they'd done Rock the Casbah and Should I Stay or Should I Go and London Calling and stuff. But maybe if I'd been involved, it would have been a bit different, but I don't know, you know.
Who knows? I mean, yeah, but it was... No
secret of the Black Magic Box, yeah.
So you played, you went on to play with several other musicians, Johnny Thunders. You spent a year or two with Iggy Pop. On the Soldier LP, you even co-wrote a few songs on that LP. How did that come together?
Well, it was the Rich Kids thing, you know, and it wasn't going to work. And I actually, what broke the band up, I sort of drew a line under it, and the atmosphere got a bit bad. You know, when you're young, things get on top of you, and you say things maybe a bit more than you would do if you was a bit more grown up. But I effectively broke the band up. I went home. I'm sitting at home. I'm thinking, what on earth am I going to do now? Wouldn't it be great if the phone rang? I'm not kidding you. 2 minutes later, the phone rang, and I answered the phone. Somebody said, is Glenn Matlock there? And I said, yes. And this guy said, well, look, you don't know me. My name's Peter Davis, but I manage Iggy Pop. We're in town. Jim's here. I'd like to invite you down for a drink. And I said, well, where are you? And they said, at the Athenaeum Hotel in Piccadilly. I said, who's paying? They said, we are. I said, I'll be there. And then got horribly drunk. And next thing, I'm in his band. But then I'm on tour in Europe with Iggy Pop. Now, the thing is, he'd been touring for years, and he had a whole thing going on. He was doing, you know, pretty good sized gigs. He had roadies, he had equipment that worked, sound guys, people to help you in the dressing room. And everything I'd done up to then with both the Rich Kids and the Sex Pistols, it had all been your mates helping out who didn't know what they was doing. Guitar leads didn't work, you know. And then I'm flying around Europe. And then I went to New York for the first, America for the first time ever, and New York playing with Iggy Pop. It was great. Some of those songs were kind of half ideas for the Rich Kid's second album, which we never made. And there's a song that he does, which is my song called Ambition, which was going to be for the Rich Kid's second album, but we never made it. So, you know, he said, what ideas you got? And I said, well, I got these ones. Well, I like that one. So it kind of works like that, really.
Are you constantly in a state of songwriting? Like, even if you're not involved in a project or in a band, you still just stockpile and keep writing songs no matter what?
Yeah. I'm now halfway through writing, or I think I've got half the songs, and then I've got half, the rest of them are half ideas towards the next album that I'm going to make, hopefully before the end of this year, somehow. Yeah, and that's what I do. And the problem is with me, you know, you ask me about favourite records and things, I struggle to listen to more newer music all the time because it influences you too much and you end up sounding like what you just listened to, which I don't do, you know. So if I listen to radio, I tend to listen to talk radio because words and phrases pop out that might help you with a song. Not always, but...
Okay, so you really make it a practice not to listen to other music, at least when you're in the mood for songwriting.
Yeah, which is pretty much all the time. But I think lots of other people do that as well. In fact, I reconvened with Midge not that long ago, and he said, oh, he listens to Radio 4, which is the big talk radio station over here. But I don't mean you don't hear new music, because you can't walk down a street or go in a cafe or try on a pair of shoes without music blaring at you.
So with the new album, Good to Go, this is available on vinyl. This is the first vinyl album you've had in several years. And it's on, I believe, your own label, Peppermint Records. Is that right?
Yeah, but it's Peppermint, but it's through the Orchard and through something else. But, you know, if anybody wants to get it, they can get it on Amazon and Spotify and iTunes. Yeah, but I have put vinyl stuff out before. I made an album for Creation in 95, although it didn't come out till 96, but that was on vinyl as well. I like vinyl. It's a real tangible object. I've actually been buying some more vinyl. My sons say, what do you want for your birthday? My birthday's not that long gone, and I'm kind of topping up my collection of Atlantic and Blue Note jazz. I've got a nice Charlie Mingus album, and the album covers are fantastic, and you know, you can put it on your hand and lovingly caress with a little cloth the dust off of it, and you know, you feel like you're involved with putting the music on somehow.
Yeah, we love our Blue Note here on the show. So do you have a large record collection?
I've got quite a lot in the attic, and if you really must know, I haven't finished doing up my place in many years because I've been so busy, but I'm having a new sort of sideboard unit put together at the weekend. And once that's done, I'm going to set my stereo system up properly with my deck that's in the attic. And then the neighbors had better beware.
Do you go to the record store that often?
No. There's a sort of paucity of record stores around now, but I do sometimes. Mm-hmm. I tend to go in to record stores when you're at Loose End Abroad and you come across something. I think, oh, I really love that vinyl album. But then you're traveling with guitars and a bag, and your bag's already full anyway. So what you're going to do with it? It's only going to get broken by the time you get home. So maybe I could get a bit more organised. But perhaps when I get everything set up nicely, I will be doing that more.
What are some of the last records that you bought?
The last records that I bought, I rebought Kind of Blue, Miles Davis. I bought Mose Allison on vinyl, which I'd already had on CD. Just got the Tari Mingus thing. But my son had bought me Mingus one.
Oh, man, you're going deep in that. That's awesome.
Yeah.
So you don't have your stereo set up just yet, but you're still collecting the record.
At the moment, I got a little, a little sort of suitcase, a deck. What'd you call it? What was the name we used to call them? I forget. You know, it all folds up in itself. A
little suitcase kind of record player, yeah?
Yeah, a little one. But I've actually got a really good deck up in the attic and some old quad gear and some nice speakers. So that'll be coming.
Do you ever buy, like, collectible vinyl? Do you care if it's a first pressing or it doesn't matter to you?
No, it'd be nice to have, but they don't. It's the music that's the important thing. But I do have a few nice old things. I've got one of my most treasured possessions is I've got a copy of the Small Faces album on Immediate, which is, I think it's called Small Faces, Small Faces, Small Faces, like a Jewish kind of quip that Ian McGlagan gave me, an autograph to me, and that's one of my most treasured possessions. I also have a really weird album that I think is worth a good few bob, and it's a skit on the Profumo Affair. It's like a sort of radio play thing, but it's actually on the record, that features Joan Collins, Richard Burton, and Peter Sellers. That's pretty cool.
So you're getting ready to record a new album? Do you have the recording sessions lined up? Do you have the dates? Are you going to...
No, well, actually, we did go and put something down. We'd finished touring. I did a session with somebody else. While we was there, we put a new drum track down for one of the new songs that I've been playing live. Al was still here, but now I'm back to just finishing demoing the stuff. When I got 14 songs done, which as I say I'm halfway through doing, then I will go about how I'm going to do the next record.
Oh, okay. And will Earl and Slim Jim be part of that as well, you reckon?
Well, Al will be. I don't know if Slim Jim will be. He's been pretty busy with the Stray Cats, and I've been touring with another drummer at the time who's good, and a guy called Chris Musto, who plays on a couple of tracks on the album. Slim Jim plays on the rest of them. That's each society, but it's probably going to be Chris. I've sort of done the rockabilly thing a bit. I'm going to keep a flavour of that. You know, I don't want it to be exactly the same. Be the same kind of thing, but maybe a bit different. But I love playing with Jim. He's a good mate. But also I love playing with Earl, and it's now become a different kind of thing.
Well, look, Good to Go is a real fun listen. I've been having a good time with that. There's some great tracks on it. I hope you don't mind if I play one or two here on the show.
I'd love you to play. What are you going to play?
I think I like Strange Kind of Taste. I think that's one of my favorite ones.
That's a good one. Yeah, I'd actually wrote that about my dad, actually. That song, although I like it, it was supposed to come out moodier because my dad was... but he's passed away now, but he had Alzheimer's. So really, it's kind of that's what it's about, you know. Mm-hmm. He didn't know what on earth was going on, and it was heartbreaking.
Was that a recent thing?
Yeah, it's 3 years that he passed away now. But, I mean, you know, songs you write maybe a year or two before they end up on a record, so. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So Sexy Beast is a fun one to listen to.
That's a fun one. That's actually in a movie. There's a movie that's out now called Fisherman's Friends that they licensed it for not a lot of money, but a mate was involved in the movie. And there's a scene where this aging folk rock band who get a record deal against all the odds go into a bar and it's playing in the background. So
So, Glenn, thank you so much for spending time with us here. And again, the album Good to Go is a real fun listen. I encourage people, they can get it on iTunes right now. They can order the album, I believe, from glennmatlock.co.uk. Correct me if I'm wrong there.
If you just go on Amazon, I think you can get it as well.
Okay, cool. It's got a rockabilly flavor to it, but it's so much more, and it's got some of Glenn's great songwritings that go through it. So, again, Good to Go, available at glennmatlock.co.uk, and I imagine your tour dates are up there as well. And you can also get the book I Was a Teenage Sex Pistol at Amazon. You can get the Kindle version or order the original analog paper version as well. Anything else we should know about Glenn?
No, that's pretty all-encompassing. But check it out. Thanks for having us on the show. Enjoy chatting to you. But I just want to know why you sound like you're American, but you're in Sydney. What are you up to?
Oh, well, I did grow up in California. And about 20 years ago, I ended up chasing a girl. I started dating an Australian, and I moved down here. And we're now married with a couple of kids.
Oh, isn't that lovely? Good for you. Congratulations.
It worked out well. Well, you've been to Sydney. It's a hard place to leave.
Yeah. If I lived anywhere in Sydney, I would end up in Rushcutters Bay or something like that if I could afford it.
Ooh, but yeah, that is quite an exclusive area.
I can roll with that.
What you're going through. You're
right, there we have it. The song Strange Kind of Taste from Glenn Matlock's new LP, Good to Go, available at glennmatlock.co.uk. But the links just wrap back around to Amazon. That seems to be the easiest way to be able to get it. But you could always go to your local record shop and hassle them and have them special order it for you. That's the way I would try to do it. But look, you could always get it off Amazon. Get the music. It really is a great album. Now that is it for this week's episode of The Vinyl Guide. Thank you so much for tuning in. Thanks to Glenn Matlock for joining us. And I want to remind folks that if you like what you hear here on the show, there's plenty more episodes at thevinylguide.com. Now hundreds of interviews available. You could also get them on our mobile apps at the Apple or Android App Store. And of course, you could always help support this podcast by going to patreon.com/vinylguide, sponsoring us for a few bucks a month. And that is awesome. That helps keep this podcast going. All right, well, we'll be back shortly with a brand new episode. So until we talk next time, keep spinning. Cheers.
That's it for this episode of The Vinyl Guide. Send your thoughts to Nate@thevinylguide.com or follow or tag us on Instagram @vinylguide. Until next time, keep spinning.